Hello, and welcome to Making Creativity Pay, the podcast where we talk to people in creative industries about how they promote and market their work. I'm Dan Barnett, and on this episode, I spoke with comedian and many other things, Matt Hutchinson. We talk about his experiences of the 2023 Edinburgh Fringe with his show Hostile, from promoting the show on social media and flyering, through to working with PR and production companies. We also discuss how being a comedian interacts with his day job as a doctor, and how he somehow manages to combine all this with studying for a research PhD, as well as currently being in the middle of writing a book. I started the interview by asking Matt to give a brief introduction about himself and the various hats he wears.
So I'm Matt Hutchinson. I am a stand-up comedian from London, but I would say, I guess my day job slash main source of income, what, you know, pays the mortgage, is I am a medical doctor. Although at the moment I'm actually primarily doing research. So yeah, a bit varied.
And so I know it's a kind of a, I don't know whether you call it a trope or not, but it's kind of thing that often gets mentioned is people, you know, doctors or people within the NHS becoming comedians. Do you think it's more just the kind of complete opposite, you know, kind of, you know, the life and death situation versus the kind of more the levity? Or do you think it is the kind of job that in some weird way kind of suits a career in comedy?
I mean, I guess I think part of it is probably when you think about the people who go into medicine, often it's not so much just pure science people. So it's people who've got maybe a bit more of a broader interest range than your standard person who's, I just want to be a scientist or, you know, a mathematician or something like that. So I think often you find people going into it who've got a bit of a second interest, even at the point of sort of choosing what career they're going into. And I think sort of people try and often just foster that throughout their career as much as possible. And then sort of there will be some trigger that said, no, actually, I'd like to maybe pursue this a bit more. So like, for example, sort of the trigger for me was the kind of disaffected period that everyone had around the time of the doctor strikes around 2016, and just looking for something else. I thought, you know, just take my mind off that.
And so, I mean, before you became a doctor, so student days and all those kind of things, was comedy something you were interested in? Did you dabble a little bit then, or was it very much kind of later on?
So, I mean, I was always really into sort of writing, as in, so when I was, yeah, I did English A-level, I was really into sort of books and literature, that kind of thing. And I was always a comedy fan. But I think with a lot of people who do comedy or find comedy, you almost don't think it's something that you can do. Like, I think everyone in their mind envisages there's a kind of much higher bar to just going out to go and try stand-up than there actually is. But then, so I didn't do anything at university, but I went to university I was either 1 or 2 years above. Do you know Kwame Asante? Yeah, so he's also a comedian who's a doctor, and obviously he was doing it while still at university, and kind of we had some friends in common. And I think when you see someone else who's in a fairly similar position to you just able to go out and do comedy, like, oh, actually, maybe, you know, the bar is, you know, having an example of someone else who can go and do it. So that was, I guess, one of the things that made me realize he's going give it a go. Yeah, so that's, I guess. So, you know, I didn't start doing comedy like until I was well into being a doctor.
And I mean, how do the kind of logistics work? Because obviously being a doctor is not a 9-to-5 kind of thing. How difficult is it to find, right, you know, Saturday night, 10 p.m. show up in Birmingham or wherever, you know, but then you've got to do a day job, you know, you start a shift 2 o'clock Sunday afternoon or something.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it's weird. So sometimes it can be just completely incompatible. So, I mean, I think there will be times when, you know, you'll have a rota that even if theoretically it's supposed to balance out to no more than 48 hours per week, there'll be chunks of it where you're doing 70 or 80, and there'll be long days. So the likelihood of you being able to do a gig during that time is low. But I think you just have to be smart with your time. So often I would just go straight from work, say if I finished at 6 o'clock, and just go straight to comedy on the days that I could do that. And the flip side, I guess, would be sometimes if you've got what's called 0 days, so say when you do like an intense period of work, you may then get a chunk of time off after that. So just trying to capitalize on that as much as possible. Yeah, and also sometimes you'd have to cancel gigs because you might have something in the diary from quite some time before, and then you'll get your rota with, you know, less notice and find that you have to cancel. So yeah, it's not the easiest. To be honest, I would say being, you know, back when I was doing more clinical stuff, but having no kids, it was still probably easier to do gigs around that compared to trying to do gigs around childcare in a kind of reasonable way that doesn't have my wife tearing her hair out.
Yeah, I guess that's difficult. You know, there's probably jump on a gig at short notice sometimes, but in terms of, yeah, you know, the high level, if you want to be further up the bill and so on, a club might want to book you 3 months in advance, so they've got everything sorted. Mm-hmm. And obviously, it must be a lot harder for you to say yes. You know, next April the 12th, 7 o'clock, I'll be there. And
yes, exactly. Or you have to. So what I've started doing is just So I've just started caveating gigs. So for example, recently I got a very nice gig offer for a weekend in October. And so I've said, yes, definitely, I'd like to do it. But because I'm going back to do more clinical stuff from October as well, I was like, there's the outside chance I could get a rota that's not compatible with this, so I'll let you know as soon as I can. So you just have to give, you know, be upfront with people. And obviously, if they choose to not book you on that basis, but I've not had that, to be honest. I've just, you know.
Did the Fringe in August. So, I mean, we talked about, you know, kind of odd days. I mean, how on earth do you fit a month in and the prep for the month with everything else?
Oh, yeah. So that was quite challenging. So as I say, I mean, the structure of training and being a doctor in the UK is quite convoluted and complicated. But during your time, so I've been a doctor since 2012, and I'm sort of doing training in both internal medicine and rheumatology. But within that, you can take time out to do research, which is what I've done. So I am predominantly doing a PhD at the moment, so it's kind of laboratory based. Where, I mean, it's still very, it's sort of demanding time-wise, but you can set out your timings a lot more. You know, you can choose your structure. You're not beholden so much to a rota. I mean, I do still do one clinical shift a week, but since in a department that I have a fairly good relationship with, I was just like, can I not, you know, can we sort the rota where I'm not on call during that month of August? But with payment having to sort of come in the sense of loads of kind of bottlenecks either side of doing lots of shifts to make up for that.
Were you then still able to get the full experience of Edinburgh? Because
I was off for the whole of August. Yeah, no, I was there.
I was completely focused
on the show. Like, I didn't have any commitments whatsoever outside of that. But yeah, I mean, I think certainly in the run-up doing preparation, doing shows, because I think if anything, the lab work was quite demanding as well in the run-up to that. So I was working, you know, a lot of hours in the week when you factored in the Edinburgh show as well.
Obviously, it's all work. It's all, you know, taking you know, mental load. But did it in a way kind of seem like a break doing the comedy, or did even the research seem like a break from? Were they both work? Was it a good balance?
Yeah, I mean, I think they all feel like a break from one another, but they also feel like their own kind of drain. I think having the other slightly more serious things can at least give you a bit of perspective on the things like comedy. But I did find Edinburgh a lot more stressful in terms of the mental load, as you say, and also the kind of constant feeling of competition and comparison, more stressful and draining than I was expecting, and probably more stressful and draining than doing the PhD, which is saying something.
So, I mean, I had a look. So you were on, was it the Assembly Rooms?
Yes. Yeah. So Assembly Studios.
So it's a 60, you know, I've kind of done this for other guests. You kind of say it's right, 60 seater, it's 26, I think it was 26 days you did. So that's, you know, 1,500 seats over the month.
Yes.
Did you think of it as, you know, I've got 1,500 seats to sell, or were you able to be relaxed enough to say, you know, if sometimes it's 10, sometimes it's 50, I'll go with the ebb and flows, or were you kind of quite honest?
I think it's a cliche of kind of, you know, hope for the best, plan for the worst, that kind of thing. I think, you know, I've been up to Edinburgh in various other guises and capacities, you know, doing split shows, and I've other friends who've done shows that I'm, you know, realistic about what the likelihood was of, you know, selling out entirely. And also, you've got to be realistic about what your profile is. So I was fully aware that it could be very low some days and I'd have nice weekends, that kind of thing. But I think as well, because it was early in the afternoon in sort of a place that's maybe not out of the way, but sort of not, you know, it's a place where you have to work a bit more for an audience, I would say. Yeah, well, location and kind of like, I think, yeah, location and I think location at certain particular times. So I think some people can get away with an afternoon show, some people can't. You know, it's by no means a bad slot or a bad time, but it's just one you had to work a bit harder for. What I was going to say is that I definitely had a sort of fringe of two halves. So the last 10 days in particular, like, every show was pretty full.
You said you're performing at 2:30. Were you like kind of doing a lot of flyering and things like that in the mornings, or were you doing stuff late the night before for the next day?
So what I tended to do, I mean, I did have a production team, so I did so I was with Impatience, who are really good, and they have their own flyering people. But I did find that on days when you might be not quite where you want sales wise just doing a bit kind of half an hour before yourself did seem to drive numbers up fairly well. And it's always a balance because, I mean, flyering, as I'm sure people have said to you many times before, is quite a soul-destroying and draining experience. So it's probably not the best way of getting yourself in the mood to be doing a show, you know, like feeling good about the show, that kind of thing. But equally, you know, it's better than playing to an empty room. So sometimes when you have to, you have to.
You said working with impatient. How did that come about? Was it something you thought, you know, I kind of, if I'm going to do this, I need as much support as possible, and they were good people to work with?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think there's obviously multiple different ways of doing the Fringe, but I think the thought I had going into it was that, as we've discussed, obviously, the likelihood of me being able to go back every August is very low, so the likelihood I'm going to get every August off is not really there. So I wanted to try and give as much to this opportunity as possible. And so, you know, having a production company that can give you a bit more profile, give you just kind of more logistical support, and just give you the best chance of succeeding, I thought was a thing worth doing. So obviously, you know, there's expense associated with that, and it kind of, the more you spend, the more you end up spending, because then you end up, you know, paying PR, that kind of thing. So there's, you know, a downside, or, you know, at least a cost to doing all of these things. But, you know, my thinking was, you know, do it properly if you're going to do this one chance. And then in that case, I just emailed lots. I emailed a few different production companies and chatted to a few different people, but that was the one that ended up coming through.
In terms of people who came along, I mean, it's obviously quite hard to know, but did you get a feel for kind of, in some sense, why they were there? You know, were they just, it was the right place, right time, or they'd seen something on social media, or they'd been flyered? Did you get any kind of feel for how people came about?
I think it was quite diverse. So I don't think any one particular thing was the key. I think it's just kind of a cumulative thing. So some of it, you know, I think a decent amount was flyering. Some of it was, if you do spots, you know, on other gigs, that can obviously people see you there and then they like what they see, so they come and see your show, so you're kind of self-promoting that way. Impatient ran quite a lot of adverts. I think also people sometimes just take a chance as well. Like, you know, they just go literally, but they're just going, oh, what's on now? That seems good. I'll have a go. So yeah, it's quite hard to dissect exactly who's in why. You almost feel like doing a bit of market research at the end of every show.
Yeah, it's tough to know. Yeah, kind of where to focus. So one thing I kind of ask people is the feeding the beast of social media. Now you've got your day job, you've got, you know, the actual performance as well, and then it's almost another job on top trying to keep social media going. I mean, how have you found that? I know you probably do less than others, I think, kind of looking at...
Yeah, I'm terrible at it. I mean, I hate it so much. Yeah, I mean, I think in the run-up to something like The Fringe, I forced myself to put stuff out. So I did, you know, even if I was doing preview shows, I would try and clip up, say, little bits of stand-up and any audience interaction and try and make a little advert out of it, advertising the show, so banner across the top and an advert for the way you get to get to the end, and put those up on sort of Instagram and TikTok. So I did do that in the run-up to things, but as like a natural thing, I would certainly say I'm not a social media user or, you know, a person who's good at making content. And I think you just have to be realistic about what limitations that will place on you, but also recognize that if you're someone who finds it a massive drain and doesn't make you feel good, it's probably sapping your creativity in other ways. So I'd rather just, you know, focus on doing the bits I like and acknowledge that that's probably holding me back a bit.
For the show you did, is that now kind of done and put to one side, or do you see yourself kind of doing it at various places, either festivals or individual nights?
Yeah, I think it's difficult to say. So I'm definitely trying to write a decent amount of new material, kind of with a view to having another hour put together, not for this summer, but for the following year. I mean, that probably won't take the form of doing another full Edinburgh run. Having said that, I think it would be a waste to completely park the other show. So if opportunities to perform the show in its older version with maybe a few modifications to keep it relevant, I would certainly still do that. Because I think I don't want to be too disposable about it, particularly given the restrictions that I have in terms of just going all in on comedy. I think, you know, I'm not a person who's going to have time to turn over a new show every year. So I have to, you know, not just bin absolutely everything if I want to, you know, have the opportunity to do these festival type shows, or I don't, you know, I can't tour it because I just don't have the time to. But certainly I would, you know, happily go and do the show.
And I know an awful lot of people now, you know, they'll do their Edinburgh show, ideally tour it, but an awful lot now record it. So whether that's for YouTube or Next App 800-pound gorilla. You know, there's various places that do it.
Yes.
I mean, is that something you're looking at? Because yes, it seems that you do all that work, and it's nice that it's there in the moment for the people who turn up. But you know, you want something to kind of last, hopefully, as well.
Yeah, I did certainly think about doing it. A couple of problems with that in that, because it's quite a lot of music in the show. And I think it would require quite a big rewrite to chop out all of the music that would get me taken down off YouTube and other sources and still make it a good show. Because I'd probably have to lose about 10 minutes worth of stuff and also lose the intro and the outro. So for that reason, I can't see a logistical way of doing it. Or, you know, having the time to rewrite the show for that purpose.
Kind of going forward, so are you still trying to perform regularly, or is it a kind of thing that, you know, you've kind of done an awful lot in that August and you're kind of taking a bit of, not time off because you've got other things on, but, you know,
yeah,
comparatively time off?
So, what happened? I mean, like, I think I definitely felt quite drained after doing Edinburgh itself. So I think my keenness to be just, you know, I didn't feel that compulsion to be off writing a lot of stand-up and doing stuff, so I definitely had a bit of a break, but I'm definitely getting back more into it now. So I'm still doing a couple of new material gigs a week, and then as and when good shows come, you know, like paid gigs, I'll do those as well, so 2 to 3 gigs a week. So the main focus, I'm actually writing a book, and so that's kind of been the main focus in terms of creative writing outputs for the last 6 months or so, because I've got to hand that in by July. And also that's the most, if we're talking about making creativity pay, that's certainly the thing that I've been paid most for over the past year, or at least will do at the Linux, because of how things are structured in terms of when you get each installment. So that's kind of my main creative job at the moment, is writing that book. So that's also another reason why I'm not quite so focused on having another hour show ready for this year.
Absolutely. So with the book, is that fiction, non-fiction?
So it's a medical memoir. Everyone seems to want to compare every medical memoir that's brought out to Adam Kay. But obviously the genre did exist before. It's got things in common with many different medical memoirs, but it focuses more specifically on race. That's, I guess, an area that has been less explored by those medical memoirs, and just because it's in line with quite a lot of what I write about in comedy, it seems sensible to do that. So that's, yeah, my main focus at the moment. And whether that sort of might kind of tie into any future show that I do, so there will probably be some kind of live show that I will put together that may include some sort of material from my first show plus new stuff and be a bit more medically focused, kind of logical thing to do.
Yeah. So in terms of kind of getting that taken on, you know, and then with it to get published and so on, did you kind of produce 10,000-20,000 words and then speak to people about it, or did you, before you even started, try and have some kind of initial conversations?
So I mean, it's sort of one of those strange industry chance things that happened, in the sense that my agent, I'm still with, but with a different agency, confusingly, she temporarily, her agency was part of another umbrella agency that also houses a literary agency. I just mentioned that I had an idea for a book. So she introduced me to some people from the literary agency arm of the umbrella company that she was in. So we had a chat. Then I produced a sample chapter and a book outline for them, or once they'd agreed to take it on. And then that was then just pitched to publishers.
I mean, like you said, obviously you mentioned Adam Kay. I mean, does it get pitched as "This is going to hurt" meets X?
Yeah. I don't think I actually ended up writing that in the content of the pitch document, but I'm sure if you were going for elevator pitch, it would be "This is going to hurt for race," that kind of thing, or, you know, "This is going to hurt," or imagine if Zadie Smith wrote "This is going to hurt," that kind of thing.
I know that's very reductive, but yes, you know.
No, of course, and also it's reductive, and I'm sure as well Adam Kay would not be pleased with, you know, people piggybacking off his reputation.
No, but I think it's kind of, you know, as always with these things, you know, people want, if you can show that, well, you know, something in the same ballpark has been unbelievably successful, then people will, you know, it gets your foot in the door.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting though how these things change over time, because I think there was quite a lot of enthusiasm, say, pre-pandemic or just at the early part of the pandemic, for medical memoirs,
And then I think a huge number got picked up, and then the market's probably actually fairly saturated in terms of medical memoirs broadly. So that was certainly one of some of the feedback we got from certain publishers, from certainly the ones who passed. They were like, yeah, there's a huge number of medical memoirs now, so it could be a little difficult to break out in that sort of crowded field. And the other thing as well is, like, once you start narrowing the focus slightly, rather than just being, oh, being a doctor is difficult, but, you know, say I'm going to focus on race, again, obviously you get the benefits of specificity in that you can write, you know, you'll appeal a great deal to a certain number of people, but you are potentially, some might say, narrowing your audience for the sake of writing about something you care about.
A lot of times, you know, it's good to kind of try and challenge people and for them to see something different, but an awful lot of the time people just like to see
if
they're more familiar
with it. Broad appeal, I think, often, you know, people want in some respects. But, you know, we'll see. I think I'm excited about doing it, but I'm, again, it's the same as coming into Edinburgh. You have to be realistic about these things and just be happy with whatever comes back. You know, it's already a very nice position to be in. So over comparing yourself to the runaway success of other people.
Yes. I guess that's difficult, is that, but I mean, that must be kind of one of the hard things about Edinburgh, I think you said earlier, this whole
competition.
Yeah, so there'll be people, you know, who are having incredible runs, yeah. And it's selling out and they're going to lose. And there's probably others who are not having a great time, but obviously they're not quite as vocal about that. But you will see the successes a lot more.
Yeah, of course. You only see those silver stars on people's posters.
How did you find that, the reviews and getting people to come and see it? Because like you said, you build up momentum. I mean, was that in part from reviews?
So that was really strange. So, I mean, I had PR, and so there was quite a lot of good visibility early on. I would say I struggled to get as many reviews as I was expecting, and they came in kind of two halves. So I had two fine reviews at the beginning with good quotes, but sort of slightly fewer stars than I was hoping. And I found that more mentally taxing than I was expecting. So I think, you know, they came when the show wasn't quite where it was supposed to be. And then a big gap. And then in the last week, I had A, much bigger audiences, but then B, two very nice reviews to kind of finish on. And I couldn't tell you why that was. It's made no sense to me one way or the other. So I'd say I finished in the place that I wanted to be. It just took a while to get there.
And do you think, you know, if you'd have had the whole of, or large parts of June and July, do you feel you were kind of warming up during the run itself? You know, if you'd have had infinite time to prep, do you think, you know, come the 2nd of August, the show would have been in better shape already? Or do you think it was kind of there already?
I think in some senses it was there already. I think because of the difference, so one thing I really found was that my time slot was a bit of a curveball. So I think there was stuff that was working better in the run-up when you're doing shows at sort of 8 or 9 to a younger audience. But I found certainly at 2:30, there were certain bits, because it was a more sedate Radio 4, slightly older crowd at 2:30 in the afternoon in assembly, there were bits where you had less momentum because people hadn't been drinking and it was just less of a clubby vibe, but then suddenly you saw holes that you maybe didn't see in the development stage. So there's just quite a lot of stuff that I cut during that to kind of for the sake of momentum and just making it more tight and better. So I don't think any preparation, unless I was happened to be able to prepare in a more representative environment, would have, you know, prepared me for that. The other thing I had was, because I would in hindsight way too much tech in my show. I have had really bad tech problems in the first few days, which is often the preview shows where people are sort of allowing the show to bed in. Like, my laptop crashed, I think, on about 3 or 4 occasions. And that was stressful. And actually, I think trying to resolve that prevented me from getting bedded down and, you know, sort of properly sorted in other ways, because I was so focused on just trying to make sure the tech actually worked.
In terms of the show, you say, you know, weekdays versus weekends, quite different. How did you find dealing with different size audiences? I mean, do you try and, you know, it's always said when people present, you know, you present to one person, you know, it doesn't matter how many people in the room, you kind of almost do it to that. When you're doing a show that's maybe, you know, a lower capacity versus a higher, do you focus on particular people? Do you Do you do the same kind of things? I mean, how do you kind of change it up?
I think often you can end up in the situation where you have to focus on the person who's enjoying it for your own sake, i.e. just remind, you know, if there's one person who's really laughing, then, you know, aim it at them, while at the same time recognizing that you will never be able to ignore the person who's just sitting there, arms folded, looking a bit miserable. But the strange thing, even more beyond numbers from weekdays to weekends, the thing was sometimes I would have weekday shows that actually sold pretty well, but just for some reason a Tuesday audience would be quieter even if the room actually wasn't empty. So, you know, you could easily still have 40-something people in there and notice a massive difference between a Tuesday and a weekend crowd.
I'd say personally, if I'm watching, I'm not the screaming guy. I'm the smile and nod. You know, I might be loving it, but yeah, I'm probably not giving energy back, which is kind of hard, I guess, for you.
That can happen. Yeah, you have to learn to. I think you have to learn to deal with that, and it's not easy. And I don't think I ever did fully manage to do that. You know, a good example would be like my best review of the run came after a show that I thought was rubbish. So yeah, I came off stage really like. Well, it was rubbish by the standard of I knew that there was a reviewer in. And I was like, that wasn't a fantastic one. You know, that was kind of a 6 out of 10, should we say. And that then makes you feel like it was a 1 out of 10 because you knew you had your reviewer in. And then it was the nicest review that I got. So I think you know that's the case and you learn that lesson, but it's still really hard to keep that lesson in your mind. And I don't really have any advice as to how anyone can do that. Other than just do it.
Yeah. Some crowds, you'll get that energy. But that energy doesn't necessarily mean, you know, I guess, you know, how much people will take it away. You know, you've got the kind of, you know, you want the laughter in the room. You know, you want that feedback. But it may be that people take what you say away with them post the show. And, you know, it's still there with them. And, you know, that's obviously, you'd like that. But yes, yeah, that's no value to you in terms of feedback. But
you know, no, of course, yeah.
It's probably that.
I think it's obvious. The other thing is that, like, I've heard certainly lots of other comedians say this. I can't remember if it's James A. Castor or someone else on another podcast recently say that, you know, the audience don't know they're being quiet. Like, they've got nothing really to compare it to. They don't know that the last night or whatever night you had, they were 5 times, you know, more raucous and enjoying it loudly. They just think they're there having a nice time. And so it's a bad idea to tank a gig or, you know, make things worse for yourself just because you don't think they're laughing enough.
Going back to the book, I think you said you've got 6 months, or was it June that you said you had to have it done by?
Yeah, so end of June, I think, is theoretically my hand-in date. A bit of tinkering. There's obviously sometimes scope for that to move. It's already moved once.
Do you like having that deadline? Does that kind of make you work, or is that kind of, or are you the kind of person who will get it done by April, so it's well in advance, or are you kind of last minute?
I'm not last minute. I'd say that I'm working to that June deadline. I was trying to get as much done as possible, and I think having a kind of structure, so the method I'm finding works quite nicely for me at the moment. You know, it's cliche, but I find it works. As you know, it's called the Pomodoro method.
Yeah.
So just doing it in bite-sized chunks. I mean, I think that recommends doing kind of 25-minute chunks, but I tend to stretch it out to about 35 minutes because of the way it happens, the train I get to work is actually quite a direct train where I know I'll have a table seat with a sort of power socket, that kind of thing. So I'm finding that actually that's letting me in total do about an hour a day on weekdays plus anything else I get done at the weekend. And so just sitting down and saying, no, you're not going to listen to another podcast on this train. As soon as you sit down, you're going to start writing. Just having that as a very kind of encapsulated time, I find it works.
So how long is the kind of whole lead time from you having an idea and kind of speaking to people to, you know, ideally when it kind of that book lands in bookshops?
Oh, when it lands in shops. So I think we agreed to do, I think I'd say early 2022 was when it was put together, or, you know, when it was agreed that this was going to be pitched. I can't remember exactly when the book was sold, but it was either early 2023. Yeah, probably early 2023 or late 2022. I can't remember exactly the time. And then it probably still won't come out until, how it's 2024 now, so probably spring 2025. So books move incredibly slowly.
Yes. I mean, how have you found that you know, you've got that lead time? It's going to be in your head for, 3 years.
Yeah. You know, I mean, it's quite good in some ways because it lets you live with it for longer and actually hone it you know, more than certain other things. You don't have that instantaneous kind of just let's get it out. So it feels less disposable in that respect. But the flip side is you can feel like you've been telling people you're writing a book for ages and they're like, kind of, where is it? So you're kind of walking around with this claim that you've made with nothing to show for it.
And I mean, without getting ahead of ourselves, you know, within any industry, if there's any success, they'll always want the next thing. So is there even thought now of, you know, well, if this is good, do you have something else in the pipeline?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Like, I think there's probably more I could write on the same subject. So, I mean, you could even write, you know, whatever, this book redux to the kind of bigger version. And then I think there's other, you know, I think I could see myself writing some fiction as well, if the opportunity were to present itself. So, you know, I've got some ideas for fiction that I would, you know, have spoken to the literary agent, at least, about mentioned. Because it was confusingly, when I first pitched this anyway, it was a slightly more fictionalized account. And they wanted to say that it'd actually be much easier just to sell a more memoir structure. So all of the bits that were going to have been fictionalized, I've kind of put aside as almost a second separate entity. So if this were to do well, it would make sense to try and pitch the fiction chunks of that as their own separate book.
It's difficult, but you know, you almost have to kind of strike while the iron's hot. You know, if someone says, yeah, this is great, what else have you got? You have to have something, yeah, in your back pocket already.
Oh yeah, definitely. I think most definitely. I think, you know, also even also the key thing or the best thing as well would be to try and write a children's book. That always, you know, the rewards to that always seem to be fairly significant if you get it right. Obviously, I appreciate it's now saturated with celebrities writing books, hoovering up the whole market.
I mean, one of my episodes, it's probably due to come out in a couple of days, actually, is with someone who is a children's books writer, wrote the Mr. Gum books. And so he's now written a new book with ChatGPT. So it's kind of not okay. So much that, you know, it's not so much that he's cheating and just said, you know, write me a book and bang, it's gone and done it. It talks about the kind of writing process and kind of what ChatGPT does and doesn't get right and kind of how it pitches. You know, it's kind of a very kind of basic sort of thing, but it's kind of really interesting to kind of see,
yeah,
you know, what it understands. It talks about, you know, how language works and all this kind of stuff, and it's going to be interesting to see kind of how that goes in the future, whether, you know, you can use it to kind of get a starter and then get someone else, and whether it's going to take all our jobs or whether it's going to enhance things. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I guess a good analogy would be, I mean, it's really hard to explain, and I wouldn't claim to be able to predict one way or the other. I certainly know that if the writing process were to become, let ChatGPT do this and then you pick up afterwards, I don't think I would enjoy it or bother with it. But an analogy would be, I used to, you know, be quite into DJing. I was, you know, sort of doing it in the early noughties. And certainly when I first started, you know, vinyl DJing was a really big thing, and even DJing with CDs was actually still quite difficult. And then laptops got better and sort of DJ software got better, and the actual baseline level of sort of technical skill that was required to play something or to play a set that didn't sound terrible in a club, like, that really bottomed out the level of skill required to do that. And so I definitely found skills that I'd acquired over most of my teenage years certainly not completely devalued, but certainly reduced in their value, meant that I'd sort of, you know, the market changed. I definitely haven't pursued that in anywhere near the same way that I would have done had it still retained that higher bar to entry.
Yeah, I think kind of found a lot of things. AI gets you to the 6 out of 10 level quite easily. So
yeah,
you know, yes. There's, yeah. So you can skip a lot of the learning and just get to that. But you know, in terms of, you know, producing a great comedy show or a book or anything else like that, I think, you know, maybe it'll get there one day, but it's still a long way off. But you can get the average quite easily now.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think that's certainly likely when we'll be in the next 5 to 10 years, even more of a thing.
Talked about the book, you say you're still gigging. So what as well as that and your day job and everything else, have you got any kind of other plans for 2024?
No, I think the main things are trying to get, you know, keep gigging and trying to, because obviously there's like almost two tandem careers within comedy, which is doing building an hour show versus staying relevant and able to do clubs. And I think I'm currently doing more clubs with content from last year's show. So the kind of 20 minutes or so that is kind of club suitable, trying to, you know, get better club level gigs using that stuff. Otherwise, just, yeah, mainly writing the book. I need to finish my PhD, so I'm going to be writing up this year, which is itself quite a commitment. And then I mean, my daughter's only just coming up to 2 in April, so she's still quite a handful. So between those things, I am doing nothing else. I'm saying no, you know, I'm forcing myself to say no and not think of anything else to do with my time.
Yes, but I guess that's the kind of difficult thing. I mean, talking on some of the other episodes where, you know, if a club promoter says to you, can you do 20 minutes next Saturday? Mm-hmm. If you don't say yes, then they're obviously less likely to call you the week after.
Yeah, of course. But that's less of a drain, to be honest. So, I mean, you know, going and doing a 20-minute set using stuff that you know works is not such a drain. But a good example would be, like, I've got this show that I used to run, which was actually very easy to market, very successful, very popular, called Comedians Wine Tasting. So it's kind of a panel show format where, you know, you have teams of comedians competing in a kind of panel show style game with bonus points scored from tasting this wine, and the audience buy 3 wines and drink along with the show. And there's like a bit of a wine tasting between each round where the sommelier gives you some wine notes and stuff. So it's a very, like, you know, a very popular show whenever I put it on. Like, it sells out very quickly. Everyone really likes it. But, and I got an offer to do it at a much bigger venue in the, you know, this coming year, like on the South Bank. But the amount of time that I would have to put into A, trying to sell tickets, B, write questions, C, make sure that the comedians are actually all coming, so, you know, have running a gig with the ever-changing lineup, is just too much outlay and stress, despite the fact I know it would be successful and could, you know, raise quite a lot of profile. I just have to be realistic and be like, I can't have that as an extra thing on my mind when I'm trying to actually make these other things good. Like, for example, you know, I know that the book would suffer. I know that any new material that I wrote would suffer. So you just have to be realistic about there's only one of you.
No, that's brilliant. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, no, that's all right. That's fine. It's been, thanks for having me on.
No, thank you so much.
Thanks to Matt, and thanks for listening. There's more details in the show notes about where you can find Matt online. And if you enjoyed this, check out some of our previous episodes where we speak to people about making creativity pay.